They overwhelm you with their work. They overwhelm you with pressure.
Shoot, they score!
I felt like I did all the right things to prepare for this game.
We had Patrick Crosby score!
Give them 20 minutes of room where they can make you bleed for it, and we did.
He doesn't sign with Winnipeg Jets in the next couple of weeks. No player will be more coveted.
Dustin Byfuglien posts it in! It's a rocket of a shot!
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Pulled off the wall there by Kadri, lost it down to Scheifele, put it in with a slot, a shot, they score! Patrick Laine with a one-timer, and we're tied at one! Perreault had a chance at the side of the net, that was stopped, back on it from Verlaine, a shot, he scores! And everybody's into it, Byfuglien and Martin have dropped the gloves. Laine has scored a goal, and then a fight has broke out. Gardner across the line, though. Gardner moves in. Gardner shoots and scores. Jake Gardner ends it here tonight. The winner comes off the defenseman's stick. A 5-4 final for Toronto in overtime.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca, we welcome you to NHL This Week, a special late-night edition of NHL This Week. We hope you enjoyed the Manitoba Moose-Rockford game, the Moose falling, of course, by a 1-0 score in the shootout. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, alongside Ezra Ginsberg and Sean Assor. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website with the latest with Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. Of course, the Jets have begun their bye week. They'll be next in action on Tuesday night. So that is exactly 6 days from today, 1 day before the NHL trade deadline. They'll play host to the Minnesota Wild. But of course, there is still a lot of Winnipeg Jets news to talk about. And we look back at last night's game where the Winnipeg Lions and the Austin Maple Leafs did battle in the Big Smoke. It was a fantastic hockey game between the Jets and the Leafs. Laine with 2 goals, Austin Matthews with 3 assists, and the Leafs end up defeating the Winnipeg Jets by that 5-4 margin in overtime. The Jets taking a six out of a possible 8 points on their 4-game road trip, 2-0-2. Ezzy, your thoughts on last night's game between the Leafs and the Jets? Are you sort of glad now that the hype, the pub, the just extra attention that comes with anything sort of Toronto related is now sort of beyond, and the Jets can now focus on, well, they can relax on their bye week, and then they can focus on the final 18 or so games of the season.
Yeah, first of all, I agree with you. I thought it was a fantastic game as well, Drew. Anybody that was in attendance at the Air Canada Centre in Toronto last night certainly got their money's worth, and everybody watching at home on TSN. And, you know, we've been treated to a couple of really good hockey games here in the last week. Last Thursday against the Pittsburgh Penguins, a game that unfortunately ended it in an overtime loss as well. But, yeah, I'm pretty happy, Drew, that the hype of Austin Matthews versus Patrick Laine is over. I mean, let's be honest, guys. I mean, both of these players are generational talents. Both of these guys are going to score a lot of goals and assists in the NHL over their careers. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, nobody really won or lost if you're looking at Austin Matthews and Patrick Laine. They both won. They both had excellent games. Now, the Jets obviously don't get the extra point in overtime. You know, Jake Gardner picks up the winning goal. But I just thought that this game had everything. And I really liked how the Jets responded in this game. And, you know, you go back to that first period, the Jets almost took a 2-goal lead. Mm-hmm. If that goal isn't called back, the goal that was
Brian Little high stick that was shot
by Buff. And I thought Buff was all over the ice in that first period, guys. But, you know, when you look at, you know, the Jets, they give up that early goal. And it was a bad goal. Awful. I mean, let's be honest. Leo Komarov scores, what was it, 51 seconds into the game. It was a brutal goal. You know, Connor Hellebuck's got to have that goal. And if you take that goal out of it, I mean, you know, the Jets might not need to go to overtime. They might pick up the win. But regardless, I thought he responded well. And I thought he played pretty well. And when you let in 5 goals, you say, well, how can you play pretty well? Well, Toronto is a top offensive team, and the Jets are as well. But I thought it was a great effort for the Jets. And as you mentioned, you know, you get 6 of a possible 8 points on that road trip, guys, and you're also heading into the bye with a record of 3-0-2. So, you know, the Jets needed points, going into that road trip, and they get it, they could have easily had 8 points.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Jets still have a long way to go, and I stress the word long, because they're a couple points behind Calgary, and they have 3 games in hand.
The Flames have three games in hand.
And it was a fantastic effort by the Jets, as you mentioned, Drew. So, you know, that game kind of had everything. It had some fighting, it had some physicality, it had lead changes. It was really exciting. A great showcase of two of the best offensive young teams in the league.
Yeah, it was sort of the rare contest that lives up to its hype, Sean.
Yeah, I think you put it perfectly there, Ezzy. A showcase of the young talent that these teams have to offer. What an amazing display of skill, speed, creativity, tenacity. That game literally had everything if you're a hockey fan. If you're leaving the ACC yesterday, you are elated with what you just paid to watch. And a few things really stuck out to me. It is crazy how similar when you watch the two, Willie Nylander and Nikolaj Ehlers are. Drafted, what was it, one spot apart from one another, I believe. And it almost it looks as if you're watching one another minus the way they shoot on each other's team. The way that they skate, the way they handle the puck, the poise, their vision. I see so many similarities between the two of them. Nazem Kadri also very impressive last night. He showed why he's having a really tremendous season that he is. He was great on the forecheck and tenacious against the puck carriers. He scored. He showed some playmaking abilities.
Let's talk about the
hit.
Ben Sherrod. What are your thoughts on Ben Sherrod?
Well, I mean, you watch the replay, and it looks like, no, it doesn't look like. Nazem Kadri, you know, his feet were off the ice.
Oh, yeah.
And he launched himself into the Toronto Maple Leafs bench. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's not a suspendable offense, but it certainly deserves a penalty. And, I mean, you know, we're going to talk about Jacob Trouba's suspension later, but we've seen a lot of, let's say, inconsistency as far as how the referees and the NHL Department of Player Safety are viewing these hits. But, I mean, I thought it was a clean hit, aside from the fact that he leaves his feet.
Right, which makes it,
it wasn't a hit to the head.
It was, you're saying?
It wasn't. It was more so that he jumped.
Right, and once you jump, it's not a clean hit anymore.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's kind of a bit of an oxymoron.
No,
I first saw it, by the way, Drew, I thought it was clean.
Okay, that's fine. But I mean, I don't think it was as bad as the Malkin hit on Wheeler from, you know, the first game of the road trip. But it certainly wasn't a clean hit by Kadri.
No.
But Kadri's always a guy who
plays
on the edge.
Yep.
I mean, he's got a reputation of being a dirty player.
I agree with what Sean said. And, you know, Nazem Kadri obviously, you know, put some points on the board yesterday, Sean, but, you know, there's people out there that think that he should get some Selke Trophy votes.
Well,
he's having a great season.
And he's a guy that has improved his defensive game. And I agree with you, Drew. You know, he's had his own history with the NHL Department of Player Safety. He's been fined and suspended before. Mm-hmm. But he was certainly noticeable. And I think maybe the person who's benefited the most from Auston Matthews is Nazem Kadri, because I think he's more suited to be a second-line center.
Well, we talked about that on Saturday's show with David Alter, is that Nazem Kadri is a guy who doesn't have the spotlight on him anymore. He's a guy who, I would say, wilted a little bit under the spotlight. You know, he was the Leafs' next great hope, of course, being that former first-round pick. And he's in a much better role for himself now, where he doesn't really have to have the focus on him. He's having a tremendous year for the Leafs, and, you know, he's good at getting under other players' skin. He's always been sort of an agitator, but he's also an agitator who's got a fair bit of talent.
Yeah, and, you know, we mentioned the physicality, and Sean used the word tenacity, and I agree. I mean, I don't think we've seen the Jets play like that physically maybe since a couple of years ago when they had Zach Bogosian and Vander Kane and, you know, some more physical players. The thing to me that I didn't like that happened towards the end of the second period, the Laine goal was a killer. It put the Jets up again heading into the third period. But what I didn't like is that when Dustin Byfuglien and Matt Martin fought, that took Buff off the ice.
I hated that.
And to me, that was actually one of the turning points in the game.
Sure.
Because it takes Byfuglien, who was playing very well. And I thought Julian Melchiori also did a very good job. You know, he's coming in, you know, he's not coming in fresh. I mean, he hasn't played in the NHL in a long time, and he was paired up with Buff. And going into a situation on the road playing against a hungry Leafs team, a team that can score a lot of goals, I thought Melchiori did a great job, so I wanted to get that in. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like how Byfuglien, I didn't think there was a need to get into that. And I realized that was a bit of a retaliation for, you know, Ben Sherratt getting hit by Nazem Kadri, but It wasn't Matt Martin. For me, Matt Martin did his job. He took Buff off of the ice, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
I didn't really like that. And you know, I guess Buff is a guy that doesn't really back down from anybody. And even though, you know, Matt Martin is 6'5", just like him, you know, he's not going to back down from a guy who's known to be a fighter. But I just thought that that took a little momentum away from Buff's game.
That's a trade-off that the Leafs are going to take every single time. I mean, the Jets were, I mean, you could tell just how shorthanded they were on the back end in last night's game. Without Jacob Trouba, they just didn't have, they couldn't get the puck out of their own zone anytime. I mean, Paul Postma in that game still manages only to play 9 minutes in the course of that entire game. I mean, it just tells you that Paul Maurice obviously has no faith in Paul Postma.
I thought Postma was good on the road trip.
I thought Paul, look, I think Paul
scored
Postma,
a goal. I thought he was pretty good.
He was effective.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul Postma,
and Drew, he's not going to play 15 minutes a game or 16 minutes a game, but 13 maybe?
The fact that Melchiori steps into the lineup and plays 22 minutes last
night. Yeah, to me,
that's
too much.
And Postma can't break the 10-minute mark is a very odd, so I guess, rotation of your defenseman at that point. And I guess Mark Stewart plays 16 minutes. You know, four of those minutes are shorthanded. But I don't know. I would have liked to see Postma get a, and I'm no overwhelming Postma fan, but I would have liked to see Paul Postma get a few more minutes and Melchiori get drawn back from 22 minutes in his first game in the NHL in how long?
I'm not going to argue with you on that one because I agree. And, you know, Melchiori is a guy that heading into that game only had 16 games of NHL experience. So, I mean, that shows a lot of confidence in Julian Melchiori by Paul Maurice. Mm-hmm. But, I agree. I mean, I think Paul Postma, a guy that's played almost all the games for the Jets this year, I think he's a guy that certainly deserves a little bit more of ice time. And I realize that once guys like Toby Enstrom and Jacob Trouba come back, Postma and Melchiori are probably going to be the first two guys that are out of the lineup. But I agree. I mean, I was definitely surprised by the amount he played.
Yeah, and I just want to go back to that Byfuglien sequence for a while. You know, you see Byfuglien go after Nazem Kadri in the crease, actually, who the puck actually goes off of for the goal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a double whammy. Take that, Nazem. But and then you just see it's honestly, he approaches 43. Byfuglien approaches Nazem Kadri, and you just see Matt Martin run the intercept. He just comes.
Yep.
Full speed ahead, he knows exactly what he's doing, and then as soon as they square off in the corner by the glass, I'm thinking to myself, oh, this cannot be happening. Poor Josh Morrissey, like, who's going to be now run like a dog with Byfuglien in the box for however long, and you look at it that way. Byfuglien spends 5+ in the box.
Well,
Then in his mind, he's thinking, now I have to redeem myself for this trade-off.
Yeah.
And then he charges the net, crashes into Freddie Anderson, takes that penalty.
Well, if you had said at the beginning of the game that Dustin Byfuglien is going to spend...
That was a penalty, Drew, by the way.
Of course it was a penalty.
Oh, yeah.
It was a clear penalty. That Dustin Byfuglien is going to spend 7 out of a possible 20 minutes of the third period in the penalty box, and the Jets are still going to get the game into overtime.
And the Leafs have the number one power play going into the game.
And they were very successful on the power play. They had two power play goals there. I mean, I think that most Jets fans would take that. But, I mean, truthfully, the Leafs outplayed the Jets for the majority of that game, I thought. The Jets just, you know, when they had opportunities, they were able to capitalize on them, you know, getting timely goals from Patrick Laine, getting that timely goal from Nikolaj Ehlers.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to take it, you know, when they made their shots, they made their few opportunities count. But for the most part, I mean, there's a reason why I tweeted an emoji or a gif of the Jets defense and it being a tire fire in their own zone, because it was for the majority of that game.
Yeah, well, I agree and I disagree. I thought it was a fairly even game. I mean, towards the end of the first period, especially, you know, the last 5 or 6 minutes, the Jets were all over Toronto in their zone. And in the second period, I thought that the Jets also had a really good period. Third period, you know, the Leafs had their pushback. They were chasing the game and they tied it up. But certainly, Drew, part of that is because you have three regulars out of the lineup,
mm-hmm.
three of your top defensemen out of the lineup. And, you know, let's be honest, the goaltending wasn't the best, even though, like I said before, I thought Connor Hellebuyck made some big saves in the one in overtime. It was a really nice shot by Jake Gardner. But, yeah, I mean, let's be honest, guys. The style of play in that game was completely wide open. That was one of those games where Mike Babcock and Paul Maurice basically said, okay, this game is all about offense. Let's see, you know, at the end of the day, who ends up scoring the last goal.
Well, Paul Maurice almost had to get the Jets to employ that attitude because their defense wouldn't be able to keep up just strictly playing on the back end. They just weren't deep enough and they weren't good enough on the back end with Trouba out of the lineup. Quickly, you mentioned William Nylander and how impressed you were with him. And I was, too. I thought he was fantastic for the Leafs last night. I don't quite understand why he would be on the trade block. And you've heard talk that he would be...
Come on, guys. He's not on the trade block.
All the talk that he's the guy the Anaheim Ducks are trying to poach in exchange for one of their young defensemen. I mean, you're shaking your head, Ezzy, and I agree with you, because I wouldn't trade William Nylander from a Leafs perspective right now. I think he's too good of a – he's got too much upside.
And hey, Drew, never say never, right? But
that's
the
guy they're talking about.
I mean, he is an unbelievable player. By the way, his brother, who's Alex, who's drafted by the Sabres, is also a really good hockey player. Mm. At this point, I mean, you know, the Leafs are going to look to make moves. We talked to David Alter on Saturday, Drew, and he doesn't believe that the Leafs are going to make a blockbuster trade. That would be a blockbuster trade.
And that's something I don't think it's going to happen at this point in the year, but this certainly has been something they've been talking about, particularly maybe in the offseason, as getting that young forward for a young defenseman. But if you're the Leafs, I don't know how you can make
If I'm Brendan Shanahan and Lou Lamoriello, I'm keeping Nylander.
I am, too.
Oh, after that performance last night?
He was very good last night.
The saucer pass to Leo Komarov?
It was a hell of a pass. When we come back, we discuss the Jacob Trouba suspension. We put it in the context of the lack of suspension for Malkin on Blake Wheeler. Much more to come. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets. TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Past 10:00 PM. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Still to come on the show, Kevin Woodley is going to join us. He covers the Canucks for NHL.com. Also covers the world of goaltending for In Goal Magazine. So we'll take a spin around the league and from a goaltending perspective with Kevin. That's coming up at the bottom of the hour. Florida Panthers assistant general manager Steve Warrior. He spoke with Ezzy earlier in the day. That's at the bottom of hour number two. And also this evening covering the Las Vegas, even though they're not the Las Vegas. They're just the Vegas Golden Knights.
Las Vegas is pretty close to Los Angeles.
Yeah, but they're not even called the Las Vegas Golden Knights. They're the Vegas Golden Knights.
How many hours between LA and Vegas? A couple hours?
Four hours.
The drive. It's a lovely drive.
Yeah, you can, it's quite a lovely drive. Plus, it's very close. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyways, covering the Vegas Golden Knights, Mike Cranston of NHL.com is going to join us at the top of hour number two. This segment of the show brought to you by Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. For more information, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com.
So, Drew,
Huss is in Vegas right now.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
And he was actually at T-Mobile Arena.
Yes, he went for the Vegas 24-hour open house they had at the T-Mobile Arena. So that's why we'll talk to Mike Cranston about that, because things are getting closer and closer to be realistic for that Las Vegas, the Vegas Golden Knights franchise.
So, Drew, if they had a 24-hour open house, were there like people that had a long night on the strip, kind of like passed out in the arena?
There could have been. I don't know that for sure. I would hope maybe they would escort those people back to wherever
they're
going to
find one guy
to.
In the bathroom asleep on the toilet tomorrow.
They might. But Vegas is, you got to remember, it's all shift workers largely.
Yep.
It's a so there's tons of shift workers who would find an appeal to go there. Then can't necessarily run normal business hours because people are working there often. So they go at midnight when they're done at their shift, the various hotels or whatever, or various casinos. So they might be interested in popping into T-Mobile Arena and see what's going on regarding their newly-to-arrive hockey team.
Drew, in your early 20s, were you not a dancer in Vegas?
I was. I was a pole dancer. I was at the Spearman Rhino Mondays and Wednesdays is where I was. Yeah,
it's a fine establishment.
Yes. It plummeted when I was on stage, though. It was odd.
Just a lot of body hair.
Just a lot of body hair. Yeah. Things were happening, and really, the tips of my G-string were not very lucrative.
By the way, do you think Mike Cranston is at all related to Brian Cranston?
Why don't you ask him?
Okay.
We'll talk about him in about 10 minutes' time.
Walter White, man.
But I know who it is. Let's talk about the Jacob Trouba suspension, though. Two games Jacob Trouba gets for his hit on Mark Stone.
Yep.
That was in Sunday afternoon's Jets victory over the Ottawa Senators. Two games deserving for Trouba, not enough, more than enough. Can you separate the Trouba suspension out from the lack of suspension to Evgeny Malkin for his hit on Wheeler?
I think you can separate it, guys. And we're in Winnipeg here, obviously.
Clearly.
So there are a lot of tensions amongst Jets fans because Evgeny Malkin not only was not suspended for his hit on Blake Wheeler, but because he wasn't kicked out of the game and ends up picking up an assist on Crosby's overtime winning goal, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Jets fans, if you ask them, they're going to say, absolutely not. You can't separate the two. But, of course, we can because we're unbiased, right, Drew?
Right.
And when you look at these two hits, I mean, I think Jacob Trouba's hit is worse. But I'll say this much. I do think that Evgeny Malkin should have been suspended. So if he gets suspended for one or two games, you can make an argument that Jacob Trouba probably should have been suspended three or four games. Now, I'm not saying that. I mean, I would love for Jacob Trouba to be in the lineup right now.
Sure.
He's going to miss one more game, the first game after the bye week.
Minnesota Wild, Tuesday, but, February 28th.
Drew, it's a hit to the head. And Mark Stone was injured afterwards. And by the way, I don't understand why the NHL Department of Player Safety said there was no injury on the play.
He didn't play in last night's game for the
Senators.
Right,
so why would they say that?
I don't know. I mean, how many times have you been shaking your head this year regarding anything the NHL Department of Player Safety
right,
does?
Right, so I mean, we talked about it on Saturday's show.
Yeah.
Blake Wheeler was the victim of a hit to the head by Evgeny Malkin, and he should have at the very least been kicked out of the game, and maybe, if not suspended, Sean, fined.
Or at least had a hearing. At least something, so that the league shows that that type of hit is on their radar, and regardless of whether or not they penalize or fine or suspend, that is a hit that they want the rest of the league to know that if you go through and follow through with a hit like that, you will be hearing from us. You'll just, you know, like, we want to hear your side of the story.
Well, but isn't that what the NHL is saying then? The NHL is saying we're okay with that kind of hit.
That is what they're saying.
It seems
absolutely.
What's fairly clear now, having gone through the Malkin on Wheeler hit and the Trouba on Stone hit, is that the NHL is saying if you are laying a hit and you're going, you know, almost face-to-face and squared up against your opponent and you go through them, and even if you hit him in the head, as long as you're hitting them square, you know, square on, we're okay with that.
You can glance the shoulder and hit the head, but if the shoulder's glanced, we're cool.
Yeah, as long as you're going, you know, head on with that guy. But if you're picking an elbow, if your elbow flares up and you pick off a guy's head, where the only thing you make contact with is your opponent's head, that is where we're going to draw the line. So it seems like they're saying do whatever you want to a player, you know, that you're facing. Even leave your feet, jump at them. We don't care. But don't pick off your opponent's head. Is that a fair way to describe what the NHL is saying?
Yeah, of course it is. And when you're looking at that hit by Malkin on Wheeler in the game last week against Pittsburgh, I mean, you're saying to yourself, well, that's a dirty hit. And there shouldn't be so much gray area, Drew. That's the issue to me. I mean, this should be more black and white. And I realize that, you know, these hits are happening at such high speeds. But look at what happened earlier in the game, right? With Pittsburgh and the Jets. Two defensemen in that game were knocked out, right?
Mm-hmm.
You had Justin Schultz and Olli Mäty.
Yeah.
And I think the Penguins were getting frustrated with the way the Jets were playing them physically.
Totally.
Well, Malkin specifically.
What?
So I think Malkin knew exactly what he was doing. And you saw Wheeler's comments a couple days ago. Wheeler wasn't very happy with the way the NHL Department of Player Safety responded. And most of the time, these guys will just kind of not talk about it. And Paul Maurice even kind of joked, I don't have enough money to talk about this. But you can't separate them in the fact that they have the look of a hit to the head.
This is from Elliot Friedman's 30 Thoughts, just came out earlier today. So thought number 17. It deals with this, the Trouba suspension, the Malkin lack of suspension. Winnipeg players and undoubtedly the organization were upset Jacob Trouba was suspended two games for his hit on Mark Stone after Pittsburgh's Evgeny Malkin got nothing for his hit on Wheeler. The Jets are an interesting group in the sense they are tough. A throwback team. Opponents know they're going to get bruised when they play Winnipeg. That's fine. We'll go with that.
Yep.
I'll take out that section and we'll talk about that later on. After listening to the Jets' comments Tuesday morning in Toronto, I spent a chunk of the afternoon rewatching the Jets-Pittsburgh game. Two Pittsburgh defenders, as you just mentioned, Ezzy, Olli Mäty and Justin Schultz, went down that night. I wonder if the Penguins just got frustrated, leading to a bit of old-school frontier justice. Malkin has a real edge to him. It's probably a bigger column/conversation, but one of the problems all sports face now is that we like tough, intense competition, but can't handle the consequences. That was a great game, and the intensity boiled over. Not everyone can handle Winnipeg's nastiness. I didn't think that was that nasty of a game. I didn't think that was a dirty game by any stretch. I thought the hits that took out Mata and Schultz were just body checks.
Well, Schultz on Bufflin on Schultz, it didn't even look like anything. It actually looked like Bufflin let up a little bit. So
Bufflin's a big guy, and Justin Schultz isn't a big guy.
I mean, we've seen dirtier games in the National Hockey League. Certainly the game yesterday, you could argue, had more physicality. I mean, there was certainly physicality in that game between the Jets and Pens, no doubt. But, I'm just watching it here again. And, Carey Fraser made the argument that at the very least it should have been a game misconduct. And
I agree with him.
And again, we already covered this on Saturday's show, but it shouldn't be if it's the deliberate intent to make the contact with the head. If you make contact with your elbow to a guy's head, you hit the guy in the head. I mean, right? That's what you're trying to
you're
take out of the game.
Intent follows the bullet, meaning intent follows the action, regardless of what your motive may have been after the fact.
It's like high-sticking someone in the face
by
accident.
You're responsible for your own body, right?
Yep.
No, I don't disagree with you guys there at all. It seems like even though I think that makes sense, and I think most hockey fans would say that makes sense, the NHL and the NHL Department of Player Safety, and I can also include the players in it, because if the players were screaming bloody murder, things would change. And the owners, I would include them in it, because if they were screaming bloody murder, things would change. They all seem to be okay with body checking, even if it's a body check to the head, as long as you are coming head on with the guy. When you're coming body to body, chest to chest, or shoulder to intention being chest and getting
and that's kind of what the Department of Player Safety said, right, guys? They said the difference between these two hits is that Malkin launched himself at Wheeler, and it wasn't a hit where he hit his head first. It was shoulder and then to the head, right? So, but if you look at the replay, I mean, it's pretty much all Wheeler's head.
And Malkin leaves his feet. And it used to be, maybe last year or 2 years ago, if you left your feet to deliver a body check, that is going to almost get you suspended. That's almost one of those things. There's no question about it. Now it's, if you pick a player's, head off with your elbow or with your shoulder, that's going to get you suspended. But then again, I look back earlier in the year, the hit, I think it was Kadri that leveled, was it Daniel
Sedin? Daniel Sedin, yeah. That's,
and that one, to the life of me, I still don't understand why that one wasn't a suspension, yet the Trouba one was.
Just real quick before we break, the Jets, I've listened to a bunch of the audio over the past few days just because they've been probed about it so much, and they continuously reference the Anton Strahlman hit on Brian Little. From last year. That gets brought up a lot, just with regards to continuity and, just keeping the same kind of punishments level throughout the NHL. And they've referenced that hit a lot, just saying that he didn't even receive a fine or a hearing for that hit. So it's interesting. I think that's why the Jets are so miffed, is because they feel that they've been treated unfairly over a full year.
But yeah, it's not just one isolated incident.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Like Brian Little literally broke his back.
Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine joins us next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
On your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290. TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour here on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. This segment brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the program Kevin Woodley. Kevin covers the Vancouver Canucks for NHL.com. He can also find his work at In Goal Magazine. Kevin, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, guys.
Kevin obviously brought you on. We want to take a spin around the NHL, but we'll start in Vancouver, where you're based and where you spend a lot of time watching the Vancouver Canucks. And Ryan Miller is such an interesting case in that this is a guy who's going to be an unrestricted free agent at season's end. Obviously, a veteran goaltender towards the end of his career, but putting up very good numbers and having a very solid year for the Vancouver Canucks. Can you foresee an instance where Ryan Miller is a trade deadline acquisition for a team that's looking to maybe shore up their goaltending position? And you know, for next year and maybe another year down the road, what can Ryan Miller bring to a team that signs him as a UFA?
Well, in terms of whether I can see him being traded, I mean, obviously we know the Canucks have been slow to kind of embrace what I think a lot of people feel is pretty obvious, that they should be sellers. I believe he has a limited no trade, and there was a list of five teams submitted before the season that he would accept the deal to. Widely expected that those teams would be California-based. He's made no secret of the fact that he wants to be close to his wife, who obviously is an actress in Hollywood and their young child. So geography plays a role there. The Canucks' willingness to move him plays a role there. They're perhaps interested in having him next season to continue to split time with Jacob Markstrom plays a role there. As far as interest around the league, one thing I wanted to say is, it's funny, it didn't go well for him in St. Louis in 2014 after the trade to Buffalo. And I think there's a lot of people that feel the fact he struggled with that transition from one team to another midseason would hurt his chances, or, you know, in a goalie-rich market right now, where there's a lot of big names available, would maybe hurt the value you might get back for a Ryan Miller. And part of me thinks that, you know, there are a couple of factors there that I would disagree with that statement. One of them being, when he left Buffalo, that was the first trade he had ever had in his career, right? So his entire career had been spent in one place. And that's funny, talking to Devin Dubnyk recently, and I've got a column coming out on Friday on NHL.com that kind of looks at the factors we should consider when looking at a goaltender, well beyond save percentage or even adjusted metrics. One of them is preparedness for a trade. And Dubnyk felt like he did so well in Minnesota because he learned what not to do with the trade from Edmonton to Nashville the year before. So that was a factor for Ryan Miller. He also went from a team in Buffalo that was bleeding odd man rushes to a team in St. Louis that didn't give them up at all and played mostly end zone style defense. Again, Ryan Miller, a guy who that year had consciously made an effort in Buffalo to be more aggressive, more assertive, play with a lot of backwards flow in his game, get out early, retreat with the play. He's always and still is a guy who likes to have some flow, some timing, some rhythm in his game. He likes to try and set people up. It's kind of a lost art, but he likes to try and bait guys and get them to go to certain sides and move the pucks in certain ways. And in Buffalo, that worked. In St. Louis, it didn't, for a couple of reasons. That style of goaltending tends to rely a little more heavily on rhythm and timing. Harder to find your rhythm and timing when you're not facing a lot of shots like he was in Buffalo, like he wasn't in St. Louis. And then the last part, and this is the part that I think would hurt his value on the trade market, if you understand goaltending and are really looking beyond just raw numbers or, you know, intangibles like experience, is Ryan, every goalie relies on reads and making the right reads, some more heavily than others. And he's a guy who's big on reads. And in St. Louis, where he would want to step out, for example, and be aggressive on a guy and trust his D has the back door, well, that wasn't how they played there. And so him stepping out would put him out of position. He'd step out on a short side, pass would go to the far side, just little tiny reads. And it was interesting talking to him recently about Nikita Trampkin, the big 6'7" Russian defenseman here in Vancouver. He was praising Trampkin for his improvements, but one of the things he talked about was his ability to read on what Nikita was doing on the ice. And don't forget, they've been together now like 4 months, and he's just now trusting that read. So when you hear him say that, when you know how dependent he is on reads, and you hear him say that he's just now getting comfortable with how Nikita's going to play certain things 4 months in, you've got to ask, how are you going to adjust to a new system, 6 new defensemen, and you've only got a month to do it before playoffs? So that is the one caveat that I would throw out there. I don't think he can use the Buffalo to St. Louis thing as a catch-all for Ryan Miller, but I do think some of the intricacies in the position that he struggled adjusting to in St. Louis still apply if you're asking him to make a change. You'd want to make sure it's at least a similar system and defensive structure if you're going to make a deal for Ryan Miller.
So, Kevin, if the Vancouver Canucks decide to trade Ryan Miller before the trade deadline or not re-sign him in the offseason, does that mean that the Canucks organization believes that Jacob Markstrom can play 60, 65 games a year and then a prospect like Thatcher Demko might be ready for the NHL next season?
No, I don't think so. The two are not mutually exclusive. You could deal Ryan Miller now and still try and bring him back on July 1st. At the end of the day, even if they want to bring him back, and they are going to need someone to play with Jacob Markstrom, because no, I don't think they think he can play 60 games, no matter what they say. Their actions right now prove differently. He's a 1B right now. If they're a team that continues to insist they really want to make the playoffs, they haven't shown enough faith in him to be a 1A. So you need to have a complementary part. The thing about Miller is, even if they want him back, they would never cut that deal now. That would always be a July 1st deal, even if they've got a nudge, nudge, wink, wink in the background. Because if you cut a deal for Miller now on an extension, you've got to expose Markstrom or Miller in the expansion draft. So you could trade him. And, you know, depending, again, there's going to be a pretty rich market of goaltenders out there this summer. So if Ryan Miller doesn't find a fit he likes better, you could still bring him back July 1st to a city where he has gotten comfortable, where his wife and their young son, Bodie, are comfortable playing. And, you know, again, depending on what the market bears out in free agency on July 1st, he may find that a better option. So, no, I don't think trading him and not bringing him, they're not mutually exclusive. I could still see the Canucks doing both this year.
Kevin, you talked about the expansion draft. I want to, you know, maybe shift our focus to Sin City, and it's such a unique story with the expansion draft and the assembly of a brand new team and focusing on the net alone. I'm curious as to the approach for the Golden Knights. Do you see them maybe going into the expansion draft looking for their number one bona fide starting goaltender, or do they just kind of go for, like, not the guy, but a guy, and then they can kind of tinker and change things as they progress through the offseason?
You know what? I think that anybody who tells you they know exactly what the Las Vegas Knights are going to do in the expansion draft either has direct connections to the team or is maybe blowing a little smoke. Because I'm talking to goaltending coaches around the league that are trying to figure out the same thing right now. How do you think this is going to play out? And there are so many factors that could change between now and then. A Fleury deal. Maybe even a Jimmy Howard deal. So I think there are just so many moving parts. You know, and the other moving part is there may be an organization with a young goaltender that you know they should value, that if they're in there anywhere in their right minds, they want that guy. But that's not to say that same organization might not also have a forward or a defenseman they have to expose, a younger player, and they might decide that that's more important to them because goaltending is something they can solve everywhere, somewhere else. So with that in mind, the hunch, and again, talking to guys all around the league, is that they probably do want an experienced guy who is capable of being a number one for the same reason the Canucks probably feel they still need somebody to play with Jacob Markstrom. There is value in that experience. I would argue that in Winnipeg right now, you're seeing them being hurt by not having that guy. I mean, how good would a Ryan Miller look in Winnipeg alongside Connor Hellebuck this season? How big was Roberto Luongo as a mentor to Corey Schneider and Eddie Lack? There is real value there. Now the question is, where do you get it? The one team that has a couple of other goaltenders they don't want to lose is the Detroit Red Wings. I don't think they want to lose Peter Mrazek. I'm pretty sure they don't want to lose Jared Carew. And they've got Jimmy Howard, who made some very specific adjustments to his game. Like, before he got hurt, he's 934 save percentage, which if he hadn't got hurt would be top of the league right now. That wasn't just Jimmy rediscovering something old. That wasn't a horseshoe for 2 months. That was a specific, tangible change he made in his game, backed off what was probably the most aggressive initial depth in the NHL. Everybody talks about Jonathan Quick. Jimmy Howard played absurdly far out of his crease and needlessly, and he finally recognized it. So he has this year. And how he plays when he comes back could be a big factor in this, but I could see Vegas making a deal for Jimmy Howard, whereby Detroit is willing to eat some of that salary, but then no longer has to lose one of the other two as part of that deal off their roster. Can protect Carew, can protect Mrazek. Don't forget, Vegas still has to get to a salary floor as well. So that's a name that I think interests a lot of people think might be a part of this equation. Beyond that, I don't think you're looking for, I think you're looking for guys, younger players, younger goaltenders that you see upside in. And the names that come out most often, I think you look at a guy like Jonas Korpisalo with the Columbus Blue Jackets, has star potential. When you look at the way the game is going, in terms of the need to be laterally mobile, and to have patience on your skates and not commit early. He has that at elite levels. His tracking and not committing too early on shot releases is like it's among the best in the NHL. So there's a guy, and the double bonus there, and look for this as a factor in those decisions, is even if they end up in getting a number two and they want to give him another year in the minors, does not require waivers next season. So that's also going to be a factor when Vegas is choosing goaltenders. What's the point of having three if you're just going to lose one of them when you send them to the minor leagues? And Korpisalo is a guy who you could send down with impunity right now. So those are a couple of names that I expect. It'll be interesting to see how the Philadelphia Flyers are able to protect Anthony Stolarz. Right now, he's the only guy that they have to expose, and you have to expose one. Mm-hmm. I think consensus around the league is that they're just going to find a third or fourth stringer from another team, be able to make a deal for him just so they can expose him. It'd be interesting to see how some of those prices pan out. Obviously, the Fleury situation could affect how the expansion draft goes, but I kind of doubt it. I think there's probably some options for the Penguins to trademark Andre Fleury, not necessarily before this deadline, but after the season ends, bring back a goaltender in return. Don't forget, they have to have someone to expose. Moving Fleury and not getting a goaltender back still hurts them. You got to expose Murray. But I think that there are deals to be made to move Fleury, bring back a guy that you can expose and still keep Matt Murray as your number one. So, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts in this one, but those are some of the names that I expect to be involved when those parts do start moving.
Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine is our guest on NHL This Week. Kevin, the Jets started their bye week today, I guess, after last night's loss in Toronto, and they'll be off until next Tuesday when the Minnesota Wild will come to town. From a goaltender's perspective, you know, especially goalies who are such creatures of routine and who, you know, every second night they usually get into action, things of that nature. How does this five-day break affect a goaltender specifically, and maybe more so than one of either a forward or a defenseman?
Well, it sucks. Let's start there. But before we get into this, I'm kicking myself I'm literally trying to kick myself in the ass right now because there was a name I didn't mention on the expansion list, and it was sitting there in the back of my head, Philip Grubauer. Korpisalo, Grubauer, maybe a Howard. Philip Grubauer, the only reason that the Knights don't take Philip Grubauer from Washington will be if a deal is cut to prevent them from doing so. Or, I can't even think of another situation. Philip Grubauer is a guy that, if Washington is one of those teams that really does have a high forward or defenseman they just value more. But you see what he's doing in Washington. I cannot see him getting through the expansion draft either. So now to the five-day break. Sorry, I had to get that off my head.
That's okay.
It sucks for goalies. Listen, it sucks for everyone. Talking to Glenn Gullitson, the Flames just came off it. And he felt like it wasn't just about the goaltending, that it was about mentality and attention to detail for the whole team, engaging in battles and getting right back into that battle level for the whole team after, as he said, 5 days in Cabo. That's tough to do. But where does attention to detail and battle level typically show up first when it's not there? I would argue it's the defensive zone. So goaltenders end up getting exposed more. One of the first caveats I throw out in every conversation about goaltenders, it never exists in a vacuum. It is largely a function of team play. And when that team play starts to fall apart, because guys just spent the last 5 days worrying about, you know, how much booze was in their margarita versus how hard they back check up the middle, goaltenders are going to be victim to it. That said, I think goaltenders also struggle to find their rhythm more so than other players. I mean, if you're not feeling great as a player, you're puck on your stick, you're just not feeling it, the passes aren't tape to tape, it's not crisp, you can still work hard. You can still get back and do some of that back check work that I talked about has been missing. Your brain still works. For a goaltender, there's a little more reliance on timing and rhythm and sort of feeling the game. The puck goes off your stick, chances are it's ramping up into the back of the net. So some guys feel like they're no problem, and it's just been the play in front of them. But some of the other guys just feel like, at no other point in their entire careers have they been asked to take 5 days off, come back, have one practice, and boom, right into a game. In some cases, afternoon games the next day. I think the Capitals played two of them coming out of their break, back-to-back. So you know, even if you're coming off an injury, you work with your goalie coach in practice for a week. You do game-specific drills to kind of get that repetition back into your system. You play some games, maybe even in the minor leagues. There's a process there to getting back to game speed coming out of an injury. There's none of that with this five-day break, and goalies just feel like, you know, creatures of habit and all those things, and none of the habits they're used to apply to this, and it's been a struggle for them to kind of get back on top of their game fast enough for that first one back.
Kevin, that's an interesting take, by the way. Final question for you here. Carey Price, former Hart Trophy winner, the best goaltender in the world. You know, a lot has been made of his save percentage this year when the Habs have been shorthanded, and his play, you know, in the second half of the season. As someone who studies goaltenders, how would you assess Carey Price's game this year, and do you think he's fallen off at all, you know, for the Montreal Canadiens, or is it maybe, you know, the defense in front of him hasn't been very good?
Oh, I think, like I said, you know, I go back to that caveat about goaltending never existing in a vacuum. And, you know, he said it himself before they went into their five-day break and before they made the coaching change. I guarantee you he doesn't take a statement like that lightly when he said they felt like they'd lost a little bit of their identity defensively. I've been watching him closely because obviously he's a hot topic because in my mind, and I think in most minds, he is the best goaltender in the world. And so anytime he struggles, people want to know why. And, you know, there was a period there in January, and interestingly enough, a period where he came and switched his skates in terms of what he was wearing on his feet, where his balance didn't look the same. Where he was on his heels more. He was sitting down, I would say, in his stance. His butt was lower in his stance. And biomechanically what that does is if you're sitting down with your butt almost level with your knees at times when I watch, then not only is your first instinct when you drop to the ice with your knees, your shoulders and your head are going to come back. Everything's going to pull off of the puck. And it kind of gets, you know, if you think of a puck coming from the ice up high, If your head lifts up and your shoulders pull back, that puck's sort of getting underneath your vision. You're not tracking it well anymore. There were some signs of that a little bit in his game through mid-January before the skate change. When you sit down like that, right, you watch him now, he's still really hunched over, and that's a big change he's made under Stefan Waite. You look at pictures of Carey Price in his stance, pre-Stefan Waite and post-Stefan Waite. Pre-Waite, you can actually see the Canadiens logo on his chest. Post-Waite, it's buried in the top of his pads. The difference this year was instead of cutting at the waist and sort of being tall in his thighs and bent over at the waist, he was sitting back down on his heels and sitting back down, like I said, with that butt lower. Now, if you can imagine, or hopefully people aren't driving while they listen, if you get into that stance almost like you're doing like a butt tap squat, right? You hold the squat rack and you do the butt tap on the back of the bench. Imagine trying to move left or right out of that stance. The only way to do it is to open up and then go. When Carey's cut at the waist and over top of his skates and on his toes, there is no pulling away before he moves. It's one of the things that makes him so good. The efficiency in his movement is tied to that lack of, okay, let's pull my left side back, open up that skate, and then go. He just pivots and goes. Early angle, early to set, it's all of what makes him so great. And as soon as that stance changed, biomechanically, I saw some changes in his game. But again, the last couple of weeks, he's back what we would say he's on it. He's back on top of the puck. And yet he still wasn't getting results, largely because it just didn't look like he could trust what was going on around him. There was still just way too permissive with passes through seams, backdoor tap-ins, just the kind of things that even Carey Price can't stop. So, again, defense is a part of it. I do think there were some biomechanical issues that crept into his game. And when I, you know, why would that happen and why would it last as long? I mean, Stefan Waite's one of the best goalie coaches in the world. I'm sure he, I mean, if I can spot little things like that, I'm sure he's all over it. Why isn't it corrected faster? And that's the last point I'll come to. There has never been, and I had this from a goalie coach who, for some reason, didn't want his name on it, but this is a guy who will be in the Hall of Fame, one of the best. Been in the league for 20, 30 years. So I've probably given it away already. He said there has never been a more challenging season for NHL goaltenders than this one.
Wow.
And I've talked to other number ones around the league, and they feel Roberto Luongo, early in the season, he was feeling it. He's like, I thought I was just getting old, but it's the schedule. it is so hard to stay on top of your game and dialed in this year compared to years past. And I think this ties into Connor Hellebuyck. There was, and this is what I love about when the Jets did bring up Pavlik, that I love that interview where Paul Maurice says, listen, we're going to separate them in practice and get Connor Hellebuyck the one-on-one time with the goalie coach that's been so hard to get this season to stay on top of the fine-tuning and the details. You know, I know Jake Allen said it wasn't technical when he struggled. And again, defense pre-coaching change played a role for sure. Hitchcock switched to a man-on-man defense and the reads got tougher and nobody was making them correctly, defense or goaltenders. But also, not being able to reset physically or mentally amid this schedule, not being able to get the time with the goalie coach like you're used to stay on top of the technical details. And I saw some of those slip in Allen's game. This has just been a tough year. And Carey Price having a little blip shows that nobody is immune to it.
Kevin Woodley covers the NHL for NHL.com. You can also read his work at In Goal Magazine. Kevin, great insights. Thanks so much for joining us this evening on NHL This Week.
My pleasure. Anytime anybody will put up with as much rambling as I do, guys, it's appreciated on this end.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Ramble on, Kevin. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Big thanks to Kevin Woodley, covers the NHL for NHL.com. Lots of goaltending insight. You can also find it in Goal Magazine. Trade in the NHL. So rare this year that we get to talk about a trade. And, of course, the trade deadline is 1 week from today. So at this time, next Wednesday, all the trading will have come and gone. Of course, NHL This Week, 6 p.m. next Wednesday with your trade deadline recap show. So 1 week left to do trades. The Calgary Flames and the Arizona Coyotes got it started. The Flames acquiring Winnipeg-born defenseman Michael Stone from the Coyotes in exchange for a third-round pick and a conditional fifth-round pick. The Coyotes retain half of Stone's salary, and if he re-signs in Calgary at the end of the season, that's when the Flames will give up a fifth-round pick to the Coyotes. So that's the condition on the conditional fifth-round pick. So as Michael Stone worth the third round pick from your perspective for the Calgary Flames as they're in a dogfight to make the playoffs?
Yeah, Michael Stone, by the way, Mark Stone's brother.
Yes, of course.
You know, talking about Mark Stone and the Jacob Trouba hit on Mark Stone that knocked him out of the lineup. You know, you look at this Calgary Flames defense and it has underperformed this year.
Mm-hmm.
And when you consider that the Calgary Flames are a team that has aspirations to go into the NHL playoffs, you know, it's a depth move. I mean, Michael Stone had a career year last year. He's a guy that, you know, hasn't put up similar numbers this year. He's more of a defensive defenseman. He's got some decent size. And he's
10 points in 45 games, one goal this year.
There you go, Drew. And he's been a top four defenseman for the Coyotes for much of the last several years. And when you look at what the Coyotes are doing, not just on defense, on forward, they're going young.
Yeah.
And we know that the Arizona Coyotes are going to be a team that is probably not going to be a playoff team for some time now. So Michael Stone is a good depth addition to the Calgary Flames. Can he play in their top four? Sure, he can absolutely play in the top four. You know, we know who is the you know, driving the bus for the Calgary Flames right now. On the back end, it's Mark Giordano and TJ Brody, Dougie Hamilton. So for me, I mean, it's a good acquisition. You give up a third rounder, but he's a guy that I think other teams were after as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teams most likely that are going to view him as either a rental or probably a guy that they signed to a shorter-term contract. I don't think Michael Stone's a guy that you're going to sign to necessarily a 4 or 5 year contract. I don't think he's that good of a defenseman, but certainly a very solid defenseman. He's not a guy that's going to hurt you while he's out there. So, you know, this isn't a major move. We're hoping that there's going to be some bigger moves out there, but, you know, Michael Stone, he gets to play in a Canadian market, so good for him. And it's also a team, you know, that could end up making the playoffs this year. So, you know, I have no problem with that move.
That gets the trading started. Hopefully many more trades to come between now and next
next Wednesday. As I mentioned, the entire trade deadline recap show next Wednesday, NHL This Week at 6 p.m. Let's head to break, and when we come back, we head down to Vegas. Mike Cranston is the Vegas Golden Knights correspondent for NHL.com. We'll touch on the NHL's new expansion team. Maybe we'll see if Mike has seen Hustler while he's down there, too. Much more to come. Hour number two of NHL This Week, up next on TSN 1290.
Legal Curve returns on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Ezra Ginsberg, and Sean Assor with you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Keener Jerseys are known as one of the world's best jersey customizers. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team or have a jersey you want customized, maybe a Vegas Golden Knights jersey, you can check them out. Keener Jerseys online at keenerjerseys.com. Check out their new showroom, 982 Portage Avenue. Keener Jerseys, where craftsmanship makes all the difference.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the program Mike Cranston. Mike is the Vegas Golden Knights correspondent for NHL.com. Mike, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here. You know, when I was a little kid, that was my goal in life, to be the Golden Knights, Golden Knights correspondent, and the dream comes true, you know.
Let me ask you, Mike, in the articles you've written for NHL.com, how many times have you written the word loss before Vegas and then had to, you know, remove it from the article?
Yeah, backspace.
I tell you what, I'm not used to the name yet, and, you know, I'm sure 3 or 4 years from now, we won't even think about it. But the name it just doesn't sound right to me personally. Now, you know, other people have other opinions, but you know, it to me, there should be Las Vegas and then a single name at the end. But you know, it's unique, and that's, I guess, what this franchise is trying to do throughout the whole process, is to be a little bit different, because they're going to have to be different to be successful in a market that has as many entertainment options as Las Vegas.
Well, they certainly started off by being different last night when they had a 24-hour open house at T-Mobile Arena right there on the Strip in Las Vegas to welcome, you know, potential season ticket holders and those who've already committed to being season ticket holders. How did that open house go, and especially sort of the unique concept of it lasting for that entire 24 hours?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was there for probably half of it, I think from about 3 in the afternoon till 3 in the morning. So still a little tired. But, you know, that they obviously, you know, executives will always say that they're, you know, were excited or surprised by the amount of people that showed up, even if they aren't. But, you know, about 9,000 people, according to the team, went through the turnstiles at one point or another during the 24 hours. And, you know, it's, the thing about Las Vegas is, you know, it is this 24-hour city, and you have so many local people who work overnight shifts at casinos, restaurants, et cetera. So, you know, at midnight, there was a lot of people there, you know, husband and wife who, you know, I talked to Restory on NHL.com. One's a nurse, one works at a casino, and they were, you know, taking it in. Another husband, wife, and nephew were there, you know, playing street hockey down on the floor at the arena at 11:30 at night. So, you know, at 2:30 in the morning, there was a line of 8 people and, you know, looking for ticket information. So, you know, it seems to be a success. Yeah. The one thing that's interesting about that is, you know, the fact that there are that many people at midnight, the games aren't going to be at midnight. And, you know, they're going to have to, because of this is such a strange city with so many people working odd hours, you know, to make sure that they can still fill this place on a normal basis when you're playing at 7 o'clock each night.
You know, Mike, just talking to you right now is making me miss the Heart Bar at Planet Hollywood. Mike, you had a piece up on NHL.com yesterday talking about how the Vegas Golden Knights almost got the last expansion payment, in time to make some moves before the NHL trade deadline, but paperwork kind of delayed that or denied them that chance. I guess, how prepared were the Vegas Golden Knights to make some moves prior to the deadline, and what do you expect the first moves to be once they're able to start getting into the action?
Even if they did have the paperwork in place before March 1st, they were still limited in what they would be able to do. Obviously, they wouldn't be able to acquire a player currently playing in the NHL. So the only deals they could make would be involving picks for the amateur draft and also deals tying in with the expansion draft, which really they can still do once that goes through and just can't announce them. You know, and for instance, they can, you know, make an agreement not to take a certain player in terms of compensation from that team. So once the paperwork goes through, the main thing that they wanted originally the date that they had to make the last payment of the $500 million was April 5th. The reason they wanted to move it up into this period in early March is so George McPhee, the new GM, can go to the GM meetings in Boca Raton March 6th through the 8th. So it's fine. Is that when that payment is made, he'll be able to go there. And I think the early moves that they can make will be simply, you know, to sign some of European free agents, you know, start to stock, you know, the roster, because they obviously need to have minor league teams as well. And, you know, looking at some of the college players that aren't going to be a part of the amateur draft, they'll be able to sign some of those as well as some junior players. So I think those will be the first moves that they make. One thing that Bill Foley, the owner, told us yesterday was that the delay in not being a part of the trade deadline was not really a big deal because he didn't think that McPhee wanted to commit himself to not taking a certain player, this or that player, this early in the process. So it may not be that much factor at all.
Mike, I'm curious, you spent a good chunk of time at the arena. What were your thoughts on the facility just from a, you know, from a superficial standpoint and just how it looks and layout and so forth?
One of the things that really amazed me, I've only been there one other time. The arena is only about 6 months old. I covered college basketball doubleheader, and you know, the facility was nice there. I obviously had a lot more time yesterday as long as I was there, and I, you know, went all around the building. And the thing that really stuck out to me was how good the views were in the upper deck. You know, the worst seat in the house, you still have a pretty good view of the ice the way the arena is constructed. They really did a good job with that in terms of setting it up for hockey. The scoreboard is magnificent in terms of you know, the size of the screen and the HD. And then if you're in the lower deck, they're going to have smaller screens underneath that you'll be able to watch rather than craning your neck to see replays and stuff like that. So you know, the suite areas are very nice. There's 44 suites. Apparently those are just about sold out, the owner told us yesterday, you know, and you're only steps from the strip. So the one thing that I think is going to be a big factor, you know, I worked in Phoenix for a while and, you know, covering Coyotes games, and there were a lot of times when it's, you know, it's a Rangers home game or a Blackhawks home game or a Maple Leafs home game. There's going to be a lot of folks that are going to want to travel to Vegas to take in those games. And it'll be interesting to see just how many of them are able to get tickets and how strong that fan base will be here locally right at the beginning.
Mike Cranston is our guest on NHL This Week. Mike is the NHL.com correspondent for the Vegas Golden Knights. Mike, we know that the NHL is in, and the Vegas Golden Knights are set to debut for next season. And it sounds like the NFL was very close to coming there, but then there, Mark Davis of the Oakland Raiders and Sheldon Adelson, the billionaire, had a bit of a falling out, and now that deal maybe seems like it's a bit on the back burner. We know Bill Foley wouldn't admit as such, you know, publicly, but does he feel that he's glad that deal fell apart so that the Golden Knights will still have the entire spotlight on them as the only professional team in town?
Yeah, you're right. I don't think he would say it out loud, but if you gave him truth serum, he would say that he would not want the Raiders here, at least not right away. You know, the thing that they would really like is to have a couple of years, 3 years, where they're the only game in town, you know, outside of UNLV basketball and football, which is really down at this time as well. So, you know, in the boxing and the other events that come here, but to be the first pro sports team and to have a couple of years as being the only game in town. You know, Bill Foley was asked that yesterday and kind of talked around it a little bit, but I'm sure truth be told, that he's not that upset that this deal looks like it's certainly in trouble, if not gone, and we'll see what happens here lately. But it doesn't appear, certainly the Raiders won't be playing here next season or the year after. So it'll be probably a couple of years down the road before he faces that kind of competition.
Mike, when are we going to find out who Vegas's head coach is, and who do you think the front runner is right now?
I think the front runner would probably be Jack Capuano, the Islanders. The guy was fired from the Islanders. I believe that the reason for that would be that McPhee, when he was let go by Washington, he worked as an advisor with the Islanders, so he knows him. They're on friendly terms. And the other aspect was that Bill Foley, a couple of weeks ago, talked about not wanting to break the bank on a coach right away. When Claude Julien became available, they seemed to squash that right away, that it would not be a guy that they would want to pay that kind of money. So I think that would kind of get rid of a guy like Hitchcock as well, guys that would demand a big money contract. And I think that, Gallant is a guy that they've also talked to. I think those are the two guys probably right now. When a few months ago they were really adamant that they would not hire a new coach until after the regular season, they have not. They've moved that up possibly because so many coaches have been fired, and the possibility is they could lock them up before the end of the regular season. I wouldn't be surprised if a move is made in the next 4 to 6 weeks or so.
Mike, it's a really interesting perspective for marketing, and just when you look at the team and how they're going to try to market themselves to the fans in Vegas and yet also to the visiting fans to Sin City, and just to me it makes kind of sense to kind of take advantage of all the hotels on the strip, and Vegas is such a big city with regards to comping and catering to your guests. And do you kind of foresee kind of a partnership, I want to say, with the team and the hotels to kind of promote the team, like, kind of stay with us and here's a free meal and two tickets to the Vegas Golden Knights? Did you kind of see that kind of marketing kind of working its way in?
When I got here, I thought that would be probably what they would do. But in talking with a lot of the executives over the past couple of days and during the 24-hour event last night, there seems to be a real effort that they want to have a home ice advantage. They want to make sure that the locals are the fan base, and they're not constantly depending on, the convention traveler, the tourist coming in, which would be more than likely not rooting for the Golden Knights. Their goal is, and apparently what they will succeed in doing, is to have 14,000 either season tickets, full season tickets, or partial plans, which would mean there would only be about 3,500 tickets available for the general public each game. However, I talked to one woman last night whose parents bought a season ticket package down close to the ice with VIP access and all that, and she flat out said this is going to be an investment, and they'll be putting their tickets up for sale, especially when the big ticket teams come into town. So, like I said, being in Arizona, that was kind of the setup as well. You had 6,500 or real diehard Coyotes fans, and then if the arena was going to be filled, it was going to be a lot of fans from the other team. So, I think that especially with as many people buying season tickets, there's going to be a lot of those that are probably going to try to unload them, make a little bit of money, and you'll see a lot of package deals as a result through the hotels. The MGM Grand and New York hotels are right next to the arena on that side of the strip. And, they're part owners of the arena as well. So you're going to see, I'm sure, a lot of deals like that. But Bill Foley is really adamant that he doesn't want this to be a, 50-50 neutral crowd every game, that he wants to make sure that the crowd is mostly local Vegas fans.
Mike, we'll let you go on this last question. And it's not so much about the Golden Knights, but it's about sort of the youth hockey culture that has propped up in Las Vegas. Particularly, Vegas, a lot of people don't know this, it hosts a number of youth hockey tournaments, international youth hockey tournaments. Just how important have those tournaments been to sort of building a culture of hockey in the Las Vegas area?
It's been big. They, as you mentioned, there's more sheets of ice here than you would think. A lot of them are tied into the resorts or the casinos or et cetera. They're also looking to do more. One of Bill Foley's, the owner's initiatives is to build a bigger youth hockey program here. But as you mentioned, there are a lot of tournaments that occur already. And, you know, that I think is the key for this organization. You know, you get young kids in there not only to play hockey, but then, you know, to become fans of the team, and you grow up and, you know, there's no question that you're going to be, you know, you grew up in Vegas right now and you're probably a Kings or a Ducks fan if you are, you know, follow hockey closely. So the youth hockey initiative is definitely going to be a big part of this team, and they're really stressed it so far. They're going to be hiring a youth hockey coordinator, from what I understand, with an announcement coming pretty soon. So that's going to be a big part of what's on the table here, as well as building more rinks in the area.
Yeah, I was there, I think it was 2 years ago now. I was at the Red Rock, and there was a whole group of people there that were down in I think they were Canadians from Calgary, that were down in Vegas for a youth hockey tournament. And I believe the practice facility for the Golden Knights is right across the street in Summerlin. Is that right?
It is.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, right across the street from the Red Rock, yeah. And that is supposed to be open to the public when the team is not using it, and there will be a couple of sheets of ice there as well. So, you know, that, and that's kind of in the real fast growing suburb area of Las Vegas. So, you know, the team has definitely stressed that they really want to get the youth hockey program up and going here even stronger than it has, even though it is, you know, surprisingly for you know, a climate of this pretty strong already.
And Drew, while we have Mike on, we should, you know, give a shout out to Pokey Redick, former Winnipeg Jets goaltender. He played for the Las Vegas Thunder from 1994 to 96, and I believe he still calls Vegas home.
Well, there you go.
Is that right? Yeah.
There's some ties between, not that you needed more ties between Winnipeg and Vegas with all the Canadians that tend to visit down there, but there's some ties between the Jets and, I guess, Vegas hockey right there. Mike Cranston covers.
I'm sure that I'm going to see a lot of Jets jerseys here when the Winnipeg's in town for a couple times next season.
I can guarantee you that there's going to be no shortage of Jets fans if you see what it's like when the Jets visit the Coyotes. It's half Jets fans, so I expect it's good. You're going to see similar there in Las Vegas.
Yeah, Mike, you can bet on it.
Oh, be quiet. Don't laugh at that, Mike. It just encourages him. Mike Cranston covers the Vegas Golden Knights for NHL.com. I'm sure you're going to hear from Mike more often on this program as the Golden Knights come closer to becoming a reality next season. Mike, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks for doing this.
No problem. Thanks again.
Take care. Let's head to break. When we come back, the surging Florida Panthers. From laughingstock to playoff team, we talk about the Panthers next on NHL This Week, live on TSN 1290.
This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca.
Vincent Trocheck scoring for the Florida Panthers, entering tonight 8-1-1 in their last 10, had won 5 in a row prior to tonight's contest against the Edmonton Oilers, where they dropped a 4-3 decision to the Oilers. But lo and behold, the Florida Panthers, previously earlier in the season, they were a laughingstock. They're right now back into the thick of the Eastern Conference playoff race. A point tied with the Boston Bruins right now for the final wild card spot. Bruins have the tiebreaker by virtue of more regulation and overtime wins, but they're battling with the Leafs, the Bruins, for that final either Atlantic Division spot or wild card spot. So they've come a long way from earlier in the season, right after when they fired Gerard Gallant, and the image of him standing outside waiting for the cab in Carolina, where they were the laughingstock of the entire NHL. Lo and behold, they finally get healthy, and they get a guy like Jonathan Huberdeau back in their lineup, and they get Sasha Barkov back going, and Vinny Trocheck, and all of a sudden the Florida Panthers, not a laughingstock anymore.
I wouldn't agree with that they were a laughing stock. I mean, as far as you know, the coaching change goes, they made that move because the team wasn't playing very well. So I wouldn't agree with that. But certainly, Drew, they weren't playing well at the beginning of the season. And you mentioned, you know, they've won 5 games in a row and 8 of their last 10. Mm-hmm. And their struggles had a lot to do with the fact that Huberto was injured and he missed the first 51 games of the season. But also, I mean, I think you're talking about a team that just went through a lot of change, both on and off the ice, right? So sure. You're talking about on defense, you're talking about at forward, and they brought in James Reimer, so you're also talking about in goal, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm very high on the Florida Panthers. You know, I picked them to get to the Stanley Cup final. So I was very surprised, you know, the first 20, 25 games of the season. And, you know, they haven't made the playoffs yet. But, I mean, come on, guys. You're talking about the team that won the Atlantic Division last year. And I know that that was a surprise to many, including myself. I mean, I didn't think that the Florida Panthers were going to be that good last year. But certainly when you talk about Aaron Ekblad, you know, signed to an 8-year deal, and you talk about some of the acquisitions they made. Keith Yandle was a big acquisition for them on the back end. Mm-hmm. And they made the trade with the Vancouver Canucks with Eric Gudbranson going to Vancouver and Jared McCann coming back the other way. There was a lot of moves, so I think that did factor in a little bit. And I think there was a coaching change that had the right impact, but at the time the team just wasn't playing very well. So I think when you look at this Panthers team, and sure, some of the players that were struggling earlier in the season, you mentioned Alexander Barkov. I mean, Alexander Barkov is the Panthers' best player. I mean, overall best player. I mean, you know, he gets the comparisons to Andrzej Kopitar, that two-way forward, excellent center. And, you know, mentioned Vincent Trocheck. Vincent Trocheck's had a great year. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't really had any blips on the radar. But you're talking about a very good team and a team that doesn't get talked about a lot. And that might be because of how they played earlier in the season. But, you know, Drew, I look at this team, and if they're able to, you know, get into the playoffs.
Nobody's going to want to play him.
I agree with you. And, you mm-hmm. know, Roberto Luongo, you could say that, you know, he's in his late 30s now and, you know, he's not as good as he once was, but if you've watched the Panthers play, he's still good. So I think that, you know, they've really benefited from having Jonathan Huberto back. He's got 7 points in 8 games. And, you know, this team is clicking right now.
Yeah, Shawnee, I mean, I was, you know, going to ask you about that to Ezzie's point. You know, if the Panthers are able to make the playoffs, which means that they're going to either have to boot out one of probably the Leafs or the Bruins most likely, this is a team that they're not a pushover in the Atlantic Division, you know, like a lot of those sort of weaker teams out of that weak division are. This is a team that's going to be a dangerous first-round opponent by the nature of they have some premier talent, and they have good goaltending, and Aaron Ekblad rounding back into form after some early struggles this season.
Jason Demers is another guy I forgot to mention on the back end that was a good acquisition.
Yeah, you look at the makeup of this roster, and it's a solid roster top to bottom. Maybe they need to add a top 9 forward as we approach it. Maybe a depth defenseman, who knows. But goaltending is solid. And what really intrigues me about this year with the Panthers is with everything that happened with the team, the players have rallied. They went on this run. They went perfect 5-for-5 on this road trip. They're 8-2 in their last 10. So that shows you that regardless of all the external distractions going on outside the dressing room, this team is tight. They've bonded to one another. They play for one another. They get out there and they get the results. And that is a team you do not want to mess with in the playoffs. Guys that will go to war for one another. And when you have the talent and that mentality, I agree, Drew, 100%. This is a team you would not want to mix with in the postseason. And they also have, sorry to cut you off, Ezzie, they also have the experience. So they've got the guys in the room. They've got the Jagers, the Demers, you know, Sean Thornton, a healthy scratch every so often. But he's been there. You know, this guy, he's an experienced NHL player. Keith Yandle, another guy. So these are the guys that know how to keep a room together. They've seen all the schmazzle before, you know, this mess. And when you can bond a team entering this time of the year, it is so invaluable entering the postseason. If they can get in, look out.
Yeah, and, you know, this team, you know, maybe earlier on in the season was having trouble scoring goals. Not anymore. And, you know, defensively, again, I think it's an underrated defense. A guy like Mike Matheson, who we saw played very well at the international level for Team Canada, he's a guy that I think really came onto a lot of people's radars last year. He's a really good defenseman. He's been playing on the Panthers' second pair there alongside Jason Demers. So it's an underrated group of defensemen. And, you know, you look at acquisitions like Jonathan Marchessault, Colton Sevier. You know, these are guys that play on the bottom two lines. And, you know, we talked about Nick Bjugstad. We didn't talk about Nick Bjugstad earlier. He was a guy that missed some time due to injury. So when you're talking about up the middle right now with Alexander Barkov, Vincent Trocheck, and Nick Bjugstad. Those are three pretty good centers up the middle. And as we know, Drew, you look at all the teams that have gone all the way and won Stanley Cups, you got to be solid up the middle. Look at, you know, Crosby and Malkin with the Pittsburgh Penguins. And so I'm not saying necessarily, you know, that this team is the best team in the Eastern Conference right now, but, you know, they've certainly turned their fortunes around this year. And as we talked about before, is there a hotter team in the Eastern Conference right now? I don't think so.
Oh, 8-2-1 in their last 11, 8-1-1 prior to tonight's loss against the Edmonton Oilers. Like you said, we all agree they're not a team you're going to want to meet in the first round of the playoffs if they're able to scratch and claw.
Washington might be the only one.
Well, so
they're playing pretty well too, but Washington and Florida, you know, over the last couple weeks, not many teams are beating them.
Those have been two of the hottest teams in the NHL. But I was going to add a great scratch and claw Panthers pun I was going to use until you interrupted me there. And in any event,
you can still use it.
Yeah, I think you just did.
I sort of did, yeah. I just sort of, you know, exactly. Earlier today, Ezzy, you sat down with Panthers assistant general manager Steve Warrior. We'll play that interview for you next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290.
NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve returns on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, you're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN 1290. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. As I mentioned before the break, earlier this evening, Ezzy had an opportunity to sit down with Steve Warrior, assistant general manager of the Florida Panthers, and of course, Winnipegger, so pride of tuxedo, Mr. Warrior is. And Ezzy, this is your conversation from earlier this evening with Steve Warrior, assistant general manager of the Florida Panthers.
We are pleased to be joined on the line by Florida Panthers assistant general manager, Steve Warrior. Welcome to the NHL This Week show on TSN 1290. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Long-time listener, first-time guest. Happy to be on.
Yeah, thanks for taking some time to speak with us tonight. The Panthers are playing the Edmonton Oilers tonight. Let's start off with how the Panthers have been playing lately. They're currently in eighth place in the Eastern Conference with 66 points in 58 games. The team has now won five games in a row, eight of the last 10. Is it safe to say that this Panthers team is playing its best hockey of the year?
You know, I think we're obviously very happy with the recent road trip. That certainly was one of the high points in our season, and we're hoping to keep it going from here. It's definitely been an eventful year for us in a lot of different ways. We obviously had a pretty busy off season, brought in a number of different guys, and then had a run of injuries where, like you said, we haven't had that full team that was assembled playing together until about eight games ago, and the results have been nice. So it's it's going to be a long, tough race to the finish with a number of teams fighting for spots. But we're certainly cautiously optimistic with how we've been playing lately.
Steve, this is your first year as assistant general manager with the Florida Panthers. What's it been like for you to work with Panthers general manager Dale Tallon? You know, he's got a long history as both a player and a general manager. Can you just talk about what it's been like for you personally to work with him and how his drive to win a Stanley Cup motivates him?
Sure. I mean, it's great. I absolutely love working with Dale. He's a guy you learn from every day. We talk or see each other pretty much daily, and he's just got a wealth of knowledge and unique, insights about the league and the game. That's in addition to probably having the greatest collection of one-liners of anyone I've ever met. He'd certainly be not out of place at Rumors Comedy Club. They're still a sponsor, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Okay, good. Yeah. So, working with Dale is fantastic. I think him, Eric Joyce, and I, our fellow assistant GM, we talk pretty regularly, bring different viewpoints, a lot of great interactions, and you know, like you said, this being my first year in this role, to be able to come into the office and work and pick the brain of and learn from someone like Dale and people like Bill Torrey and even a guy like Denny Potvin, who does our color commentary, it's, you know, as someone who grew up loving and wanting to work in the game, it's one of the neatest and certainly one of the most rewarding aspects of this job.
Steve, I have to ask you about Aaron Ekblad, first overall pick several years ago. He's one of your top defensemen. Back on July 1st, Aaron signed an 8-year contract extension worth an average annual value of $7.5 million. What were the contract negotiations like with Aaron Ekblad, and why was it important for the Panthers organization to get that extension done a year before his current contract expired?
Sure. Well, first I'll say, obviously, Ekblad's he's a franchise type player. He came into the league, rookie of the year, all-star his first 2 years. On the under 23 team at the World Cup this past off season, so he's certainly a guy we prioritize as much as anyone to want to be a Panther for the longest possible time, which is extension wise an 8-year deal. We sat down as a group management wise early this summer, and in addition to Aaron, talked about guys like Vincent Trocheck and Riley Smith and a player like Alexander Barkov, who we had already signed, and said, let's try to structure ourselves cap-wise in a league where cap space is scarce and you have to play within the confines of the cap, and players obviously increase their market value and their potential cap hit with each passing year and depending on performance. And we said, what type of structure cap-wise will allow us to fit all these core players and supplement them and add on additional players we think we need to build a competitive team. And when we did that, we looked at the numbers for all those guys and found deals that we thought would be feasible for us to be competitive now, but also would be great for those players to grow into and for us to be able to continue to build a cap compliant team in the short, medium, and distant future. And with Eck, we picked the number we picked, as we did with guys like Sasha, Jonathan Huberdeau, and Vincent Trocheck, and met with each of their agents. In Aaron's case, it was Jeff Jackson, and sat down with them, and we saw it at an 8-year deal, and obviously on a deal that length for a player like Aaron, there's certain ranges of salary like there are for those other players, and we eventually found a deal that we thought worked for both sides.
We're joined by Steve Warrior, Assistant General Manager of the Florida Panthers, on NHL This Week with the Legal Curve on TSN 1290. Steve, you just mentioned Jonathan Huberdeau. He signed a 6-year contract extension last fall, and it's worth $5.9 million per season. He missed the first 51 games of the season with an Achilles injury. He's back in the lineup for you. He's got 8 points in 7 games. How did Jonathan handle being out of the lineup for so long, and how has he looked to you in his return?
I think the word that best characterizes Joe is inspiring. It's incredible to see how far he's come. I remember vividly the game, our preseason game over at West Point, where he suffered that significant Achilles injury, and to see him come back, not only so quickly, but to have worked so hard, him together with our trainers and medical staff, who deserve a tremendous amount of credit, but to come back and not only return to the lineup, but to return and play at a level where, I think most people would say he's either the Jonathan Huberdeau of old or even better. It's a huge testament to his spirit, his work ethic, and it's certainly, something that's been welcomed by everybody in our organization. He certainly gives us a boost.
Now, continuing with some of the players who have signed with the Panthers, either signed or re-signed, James Reimer signed a 5-year deal back on July 1st. Was James Reimer a free agent who the organization targeted, and how do you think he has fit in with the team?
Yeah, I mean, we targeted him because he was from Manitoba. No. in seriousness, James certainly is a player we targeted. We talked this summer as a group, including our goalie coach, Rob Tallis, about bringing in another goalie who could give us a real good tandem with Roberto. And James was the top guy at that list. He was a guy who, once we were able to speak to him in the free agency interview window, I reached out that day and spoke with his agent Ray, and we started talking about what James was looking for, what we were looking for, our where we saw him both now and in the future, and both his interest and what type of role might get with him and so on. And we knew right away you know, there was a good fit on a number of different levels. And once we got to July 1 and we were able to talk about a contract, we were comfortable having, you know, we met in person with James. You know, our owners and myself met with him in New York for dinner during that interview window to get a, you know, to get a good idea of the type of guy he is. And anyone who knows James and, you know, his wife April, and you look at the charity, you know, the charity work they do, you know, both in Manitoba and elsewhere, they're just wonderful people and a guy you're absolutely, you know, lucky to have in your organization. So we were, you know, more than motivated to pursue a deal with James. And once we got down to talking about the specifics, once we were allowed to do that, we, you know, worked out a 5-year deal that keeps him here for the next few years. And he's been a huge, huge addition, both as a person and as a player. And, you know, we're very lucky to have him.
We're joined on NHL This Week with a Legal Curve on TSN 1290. by Steve Warrior, Assistant General Manager of the Florida Panthers. Jaromir Jagr recently turned 45 years old. He led your team in scoring last year with 66 points. A couple of months ago, he passed Mark Messier for second place on the NHL all-time scoring list. For a guy like Jaromir Jagr, can you just talk about what it's like to have someone of his stature in the organization and the type of influence he can have on some of the younger players on your team?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to overstate the impact Jaromir's had, both, you know, in the community with our fan base, on the ice, in the locker room, culturally, in every possible way. And I honestly don't even feel, you know, worthy to talk about a guy of this stature. You know, guys around my age grew up watching Jaromir Jagr playing, you know, NHL 93 with Jagr on the Penguins, and to work in an organization that he's a part of is something that's almost you know, surreal might be the right word here, but he's had an incredible impact. I think Dale and our coaches and others have talked at great length about the positive impact he's had on guys like Joe Huberdeau and Sasha Barkov and everyone in the room. You know, our trainers and everyone else can talk about his work ethic, how hard he trains, how hard he practices, how great an example he sets for everyone else. So, you know, however effusive words I can pick, those don't even begin to do justice to how important he's been for this team and this organization.
Steve, as you know, the NHL trade deadline is exactly a week away, and you know, some of the talk around the league has been that we're not going to see very many trades this year compared to previous years. Can you just talk about yourself personally, how much preparation you've been doing for the NHL trade deadline and the impact maybe that the expansion draft might have on the NHL trade deadline?
Sure. I mean, I think Dale has outlined our interests pretty clearly in the past couple of days, and, you know, I don't want to add anything to those comments. I think they were spelled out pretty clearly. But, you know, at a general level, I can tell you, you know, our approach to roster construction is pretty consistent all year round. You know, whether or not it's the summer, earlier in the year, or at the trade deadline, you know, in any event, we want to be flexible cap and cash-wise so that we can take advantage of any opportunity that can come our way. And we're always thinking of short, medium, and long-term consideration. So, you know, in some way, it's beyond our control to figure out and dictate when those opportunities are going to arise. And if they're, you know, if they arise at the trade deadline or prior to it, we'll certainly look at taking advantage and capitalizing them. And if they come, you know, come about at other points in the year, we'll take the same approach and act accordingly, you know, regardless of where we are in the calendar.
Jonathan Marsh, you know, go ahead.
The expansion draft, certainly that's something every team's preparing to. I know different teams probably have vastly different approaches to what they're looking to do and when they plan to be proactive with, you know, managing their roster and their interests accordingly. You know, certainly don't want to go into specifics of those right now, but it, you know, it's absolutely something we've had an eye to and we've been preparing for and have a number of different plans, you know, moving forward towards June.
Wanted to ask you about Jonathan Marchessault. He was a player who was signed to a 2-year contract last summer for $750,000 per year. He's got 35 points in 51 games, which is a career high for him. What have you liked most about Marchessault's game this year, and how important are low-cost additions like him for your organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think we like those 17 goals and 35 points. No, to be serious, yeah, Marchie's, you know, been a great addition to our team. He's another player like James Reimer who we targeted, you know, prior to free agency, who we met with and spoke with in that interview window and then signed really as soon as we could talk to him and negotiate something on July 1st. Clearly, he's a guy we felt strongly in since we pursued a 2-year commitment with him, and he's I think it's fair to say he's met or exceeded anyone's expectations. He's a great guy in the room. He's played in a pretty versatile role, you know, throughout a number of different lines and on the power play. And, you know, to the extent you get a player like Jonathan, you're lucky to have him. And obviously, when you can have him at a cap at that FIP, it's, you know, your cap constraints, it's a good thing. It allows you to bring him into a roster with a number of core pieces already in place. Been a big fit for us and been a part of some of our success earlier in the year.
Stevie, we've got one final question for you here. We have to ask you about Richard Pollock, a first-year pro scout for the Florida Panthers. He happens to also be a former member of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show and the best man at my wedding that's upcoming in August. Can you talk about Richard and what he's brought to the Panthers organization?
Well, first of all, mazel tov on your wedding.
Thank you.
Second of all, let me answer this one, you know, professionally and personally. From a professional standpoint, you know, your listeners will know this already, but Richard's a great guy, and he has an absolutely brilliant hockey mind. So he's been a huge asset to our organization. He's been that in a number of different ways. And, you know, I have no doubt that if we hadn't brought him in, there's another club out there who would have done it sooner or later. You know, from a personal standpoint, you know this, but, you know, Richard and I have been lifelong friends. We spent most of our childhood growing up in Winnipeg, watching, playing, talking about hockey. You know, his dad was our hockey coach. We spent too many nights, you know, staying up late in his basement playing hockey video games, playing ball hockey, or calling into late night Toronto radio shows when it was way too late. You know, and for both of us to now really be doing what we dreamed of doing and working for a team, but to be actually doing that together, it's, you know, it's something I really value tremendously. And, you know, I think one day whenever the music stops and we move on to doing something else, well, the two of us will definitely sit down, you know, at the lake or somewhere and be able to laugh and smile about having a, you know, a really fortunate opportunity here together.
Yeah, I can say that we definitely miss Richie on the radio show, but we're super proud of him. And I've been talking to him quite a bit through the year, and I know that he's having an excellent first year with the Florida Panthers organization. So, Steve, really appreciate you coming on the show tonight, and good luck tonight against the Edmonton Oilers.
Thanks, Ed.
Jex. This is NHL This Week with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets, TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
Big thank you to Florida Panthers Assistant General Manager Steve Warrior for joining us on the program. As he great job with that interview. Mm-hmm. In case you missed any of it, it's available for download on iTunes. It's available also on our website, illegalcurve.com. This segment of the show, the final segment of the show for this Wednesday evening, is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, officially declared the funniest place in Winnipeg by Illegal Curve Hockey. For 30 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. This weekend at Rumors, straight from New York City, Josh Johnson is the headliner. Tickets available, rumorscomedyclub.com. Remember, Jay Farrow, he's coming next weekend. And an additional show just added. That's March 2nd at 10:30 p.m. All the other shows sold out so quickly that another show was added. You can get tickets for Jay Farrow at rumorscomedyclub.com.
Yeah, that's the exact show that I'll be going to.
Yes, exactly.
So I'm happy. Nice.
Yeah.
Naomi and I are going to be going to that, and that's exactly 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Yeah. You know, while you're talking about Naomi, can you maybe walk the audience through your great chicken schnitzel experiment of earlier this week?
So this is going to be a throwaway segment, I guess.
Pretty much. It's 5 minutes before midnight, and people want to hear about chicken schnitzel.
Yeah. So Monday was Louis Riel Day.
It was all day long.
You know, celebrating the founder of Manitoba.
Indeed.
And, you know, so we had some time on our hands, and we thought, you know, let's do some meal preparation.
Meal preparation's very good. Good way to stay healthy.
So, yes, we made chicken schnitzel. Mm-hmm. It was our first time making chicken schnitzel, and I was very excited to make the chicken schnitzel, of course.
You're probably more excited to eat the chicken schnitzel.
Yes, and it's featured in the Illegal Curve sandwich, right?
The
so we're obviously all big fans of the schnitzel, and it turned out very nice. You know, we pan-fried it, had a little asparagus on the side, had a little little baked potato as well on the side, and it turned out very well. And the best part is, I've been having it for lunch as well, so it produced some leftovers. So
now, how much work did you do in the preparation versus the eating, and how much work did Naomi do in the preparation?
Surprisingly, we split it 50-50.
Interesting.
I'm the sous chef.
Naomi is
the executive chef, and I'm the sous chef. And you know, I was the person who was dipping the schnitzel and the flour and the eggs, and we had our seasoning and everything like that. And I was also responsible for flipping it in the pan.
Excellent. Mm. And how was your flipping technique?
I like to think that I'm a conservative flipper. I don't like to overflip.
Mm-hmm. You're not supposed
Some
to
people are, you know, flipping.
One flip.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. One flip, maybe two flips if one side is getting a little bit too crispy.
Control, yeah.
And did you let the meat rest before you cut into it afterwards? You always have to left your meat rest.
I let it rest a little bit, yeah.
Did you flip important. Away yeah. from you? When you're dealing with hot oil, it's always important to flip away from
yeah,
you.
Yeah, the worst is when you get like hot oil like on your cheek or something.
Yeah.
That would be very painful.
But yeah,
what about dishes?
It turned out great.
Who does the dishes?
Everything is 50-50 in our household.
It's very good of you.
Yeah, I'm getting ready for marriage, Drew.
You are very very domesticated. You're like a house cat at this point in time. Now, Sean, you had some adventures when it came to food as well.
Yeah.
This is your roommate really takes the cake on this one. This is a remarkable performance by your roommate on this one.
This is what happens when I leave the house for 8+ hours unattending. Yeah. My roommate unattended at home, left to go. So
left to his own devices.
I also did some cooking Monday.
Sean, you're always doing some cooking.
Chef,
I whip it up.
Yeah.
So I cleaned out the cupboards. I saw a couple cans of chickpeas, made myself some hummus, a lovely, healthy dip.
Mm-hmm. Little Mediterranean
exactly,
style
little,
dip.
Yeah. Take lovely. It back to the homeland.
Yeah, some pita. Yeah,
and come home, roommate's like, man, I don't know what kind of garlic butter you made, but I fried it up with some noodles, and it was amazing. And I said, that was hummus. And he looked at me and goes, it was delicious. So tossing noodles in blended chickpeas.
Shout out to Mogi.
admittedly, it's been a long time since I've had a roommate that wasn't my wife or didn't turn into my wife. So I'm surprised that you have that relationship with your roommate where he's allowed to take your food.
No.
Okay. Because that would be where I would sort of start and stop the conversation there.
Yeah. Especially when you notice that the scoop coming out of it is in a finger shape.
Ooh.
the middle and pointer finger.
And you guys have a long history because
this is our second time
living together.
Before
you moved into your house, you used to live with Sean. So
before I moved away, yeah.
So Sean lives with Sean.
Yes,
two
Seans.
Yes.
And speaking of Sean Asor, I've been able to, lucky enough, I should say, to eat some of his cooking. Sean's a good chef. If you follow him on Instagram or Snapchat, Sean's always cooking something new. And it's usually very good.
So did you have a conversation about why he took your food in an unauthorized manner?
No, I was just laughing at the fact that he thought blended chickpeas were butter, and I kind of
he's got enough issues on his own.
Yeah,
at that point
just leave it
time.
At that. Yeah,
yeah, you're going to get the last laugh when he suffers a coronary after he fried his hummus with pasta.
It's a guy allergic to peanuts moved to Thailand for a year.
Yeah.
Quickly, we got a couple minutes before the top of the hour, and we have to head out. Trade deadline coming up 1 week from tonight. Are you expecting it to be busy? Have you changed your mind at all, Sean? I know Ezzy and I are sort of on the same page that we think it's going to be heavily focused on just pending UFAs.
Well, I can speak to the Jets. I had a piece up on the site yesterday.
Yeah.
And
don't give it away. We'll talk about it on Saturday as well.
Well, I don't think the Jets or many other teams are going to be busy, and that has to do partly with the fact that you have the expansion draft coming up. There's going to be some trades, but certainly it's not going to be one of the busier years, and Drew, you agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But some big names are going to move. Probably see Kevin Shattenkirk move teams.
Mm-hmm. That's the big one.
I think
on
Marty Hansel might be leaving the desert. A really interesting one for me is Brian Boyle. He, on his last year of his contract with Tampa Bay, he's got a plethora. I was going to say plethora, but...
That would be wrong.
Yeah, a plethora of playoff experience. I believe he's been to the Eastern Conference Finals twice and the Cup Finals twice in the past 5 years.
Sure, with the Rangers
and
the Lightning.
Yeah, so any team looking for valuable playoff experience and a big centerman, Brian Boyle is pretty tempting.
Yeah, well, Edmonton apparently really wants him.
There you go. We will know more, of course, in exactly 1 week's time. That's it for this Wednesday late night edition of NHL This Week. Big thanks to our guest, Kevin Woodley of NHL.com and In Goal Magazine, Mike Cranston, Vegas Golden Knights correspondent for NHL.com, and Steve Warrior, the assistant general manager of the Florida Panthers. In case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on iTunes at tsn1290.ca. And on our website, you can follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and as I mentioned, our website with the latest Jets and Moose news is IllegalCurve.com. Big props to producer Rory, doing a great job behind the board. For Sean Asor, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Until Saturday morning at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck.
As long as we stick together, the team will be all right.